From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Experts have been much quoted in the coronavirus crisis, but no one has better qualifications on this subject than Peter Doherty. His research on the immune system won him the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1996, and he's authored a book titled Pandemics, What Everyone Needs to Know. The highly respected Doherty Institute is named in his honour, and he is its patron. The Institute is where much of the vital Australian research on the virus is being done. Peter Doherty joins us today from his home in Melbourne. Please forgive the audio not being ideal from a home telephone. Peter Doherty, just before we drill down into the detail, let me ask you, what does everyone need to know about a pandemic? What would be your most urgent messages?
With the pandemic, the necessity is to listen to what's being said by the relevant authorities, the public health people. And in this case, we're seeing a lot of that articulated by the Prime Minister, the Chief Medical Officer, and state premiers and their representatives as well. So listen to what's being said, take notice and follow the instructions.
Mind you, one of the features, I think, of what's been going on is that not all the authorities are on the same page. There is difference, including among the experts, isn't there?
There's differences of opinion re some of the policy issues. I don't think there's much difference in opinion or much difference space anywhere between the various scientists and so forth. But policy, of course, is a much more difficult issue, and I don't interface with that. It's way above my pay grade, policy. I'm just a lab rat. So really, there has been some confusion in messaging early on. I think that's gradually come together, because there is now a sort of national medical committee on this, chaired by the Prime Minister. But there is we're a federal system, and we're all familiar with the idea that we get different messages from different states in Australia. But I think basically everyone's much on the same page. It's just a bit of the details may differ, but everyone is advocating social distancing and responsible behaviour, and that's the really important thing.
Now, in this pandemic, what don't we know, especially about it, the transmission of the virus, the infection, the mutation?
We're learning very quickly, Michelle. We've only known about this virus for at most 4 months. And what we're learning is a lot about how it transmits and how readily it transmits. The initial idea is that it transmitted at about the same level as influenza. It seems to be transmitting at a higher level than that, if anything. We give it an R0. That's the number of people who are likely to be infected by any single person, around 2.5 to 3. And, of course, if people are really crowded together, one person can infect many, many more than that. And we all know the stories about the dinner party of 12, where one was positive when they arrived and all 12 were positive by the time they left.
Say nothing of the wedding, where I think some 36 people or thereabouts were infected.
Yes. It's the problem of dealing with a respiratory infection. You know, it's different from, say, AIDS. We can all modify the way we behave in the sexual sense, but we can't decide not to breathe. And so it's very important that we keep that social distancing right at the front of our mind. In fact, one of the best pieces of advice I've seen is think of as though you've already got it and you don't want to transmit it to anybody else. And if you think like that, you'll protect yourself.
Is it this high rate of infection that makes it a pandemic?
Yes, because it's spread globally. We didn't have a pandemic with SARS, the initial one, a very similar virus but more lethal, that came up in 2002, 2003, because it just didn't spread as effectively as this one. This one spreads really fast, and that's why it's got to a lot of countries. It's now in 196 countries. The only place that SARS, the original SARS, went out of Asia was to Toronto. And so this is an incredibly infectious virus that's very readily spread by travellers and so forth, and that's what makes it a pandemic. Pandemic means across the planet, of course, so all the people are at risk here.
I think we haven't heard a lot about what's happening in Africa. We've heard more about Europe and Asia. What's the story in Africa, and when it really gets going there, it presumably could be particularly bad, you'd think?
Absolutely. It will be terrible because you've got a lot of people in Africa with what we call comorbidities, other medical problems due to a variety of things. And what we think is that, what we know is that if you don't have a strong public health system and sophisticated science, you won't be testing very extensively for it. We're familiar with that because we're getting calls from all over the Pacific region and local region to help them set up testing, but it will never be the case that there's extensive testing in many of those communities. They just don't have the infrastructure. So that's one of the reasons I argued in that pandemics book that you mentioned that basically it's very, very important to maintain the infrastructure. So we don't really know, but we're pretty certain that this virus is in just about every country. And without any real capacity for monitoring, the only thing they can do to try and protect themselves is social distancing.
Just on this question of testing, we hear the numbers are ramping up. But surely as this spreads, you're going to need round after round of testing, because if someone tests negative today, it doesn't mean that he or she will be negative in a month's time, does it?
No, the main point of the testing at this stage is, I think, well, firstly to monitor the infection, but also to identify people who are definitely clinical cases of this. Now, basically, the testing we're doing is all for the presence of virus. That is what's called a PCR test. This is very similar to the test that's used to identify rapists, basically. It identifies genetic sequence and identifies that the individual has in their nose and throat the genetic sequence of the virus, which means they're infected. Now, that means that we're only detecting people with current infection. We're not detecting people who might have been infected and recovered. For that, we need a screening antibody test to detect the footprint of infection. That is the antibodies that have developed as the infection goes on and will now be protective. So we've been at a loss about background incidents at this stage. The Chinese are ahead of us on that, and I can talk about that if you want me to.
Well, tell us, yes, about the Chinese.
Well, the Chinese were initially reporting from Wuhan, from the massive outbreak that they got onto so dramatically, that they were seeing a 2.5% death rate. Now, that's pretty terrifying because the death rate for normal influenza is about 0.1%. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about 25 times as many people dying. Now, what wasn't understood right at the beginning, and because they were so obsessed with identifying the likely transmitters in clinical cases, is that there actually is a lot of relatively asymptomatic or completely asymptomatic infection in people who can also be carriers. And once they were able to get those figures, their estimate of the death rate has dropped from 2.5% to 1.4%. So that's good. I mean, it means that to see the death rate go down is good. They were initially reporting that the death rate in people in their 80s was something like 14 or 15%. Well, that's at least halved, it seems. So that, again, is good.
How do you explain the differences in the case numbers between, say, Italy and Australia, because both are first world countries, both have solid medical and health systems?
Well, due to the fairly stringent procedures the government here adopted early on, we've delayed the onset in Australia, and we bought a lot of time. We've also got a pretty sophisticated medical laboratory scene, though Italy has too, really. But Italy didn't take those steps, and they got the disease in big numbers, I think, and they had it for a while before they even realized they had it. We've been doing a lot of background testing. People have been saying we're not testing enough. Well, actually, nobody can test enough because there's not enough reagents on the planet and all the rest of it. But we've been doing a lot of background testing by international standards. And until about Tuesday of last week, even when we were testing people who were coming in to the fever clinics at Royal Melbourne Hospital, which was set up to deal with this infection, or testing the people that were being sent in by their doctors because they had some sort of respiratory disease and so forth, we were still finding less than 1% of people positive. So that means there was very little background infection in the community in Melbourne. And if you think of the demographics and so forth in Melbourne, Melbourne's exactly the sort of place you'd expect a lot of it. Now, with respect to the disease, Sydney has been a bit ahead of us. They've climbed up more quickly than we have. So, and of course, that's a major portal of entry into Australia, and they all came into Australia from somewhere else initially. So we think we bought a lot of time, and that now we're starting to see it ramp up, and actually also the criteria for testing are being relaxed a bit, and we'll see more positives come up because we're going to be testing more broadly. That will sort of flatten out, and we'll start to see a more stable situation, if you like.
One argument has been that countries perhaps should adopt the so-called herd immunity course of dealing with this virus. Could you explain how that works, and what do you think of that argument?
It's the basis of all the responses in a way. The difference is that the herd immunity argument that has been presented has been, well, let everyone get infected, take the consequences, and the sooner everybody's infected, the sooner we'll all be immune, or large numbers will be immune, and then the rate of transmission will drop, the risk will drop, and people can get back to work. So that's the sort of argument that was being attributed to the Brits and to the Dutch. Now, we all want to see herd immunity. We just want to get there a bit slower. And to back up a bit, you know, you get infected with a virus, you recover from the infection, you've then got antibodies in your blood and you're immune and you're not going to get reinfected again. And we don't think there's any good evidence you can get reinfected again with this virus. So once you're in that category, you're free and clear. We could take all the people who've had the infection, recovered, and just send them out to live normally. And that may be something that can be done in the later time because, you know, they are the people who could help look after people and deliver stuff and do all that sort of thing and be at no risk to themselves. So what we want to do here, and what the Prime Minister is trying to do, is to flatten the curve. That is to slow the rate of infection. And the reason for that is we don't want to get into the situation the Italians got into, where their health services were simply overwhelmed. It'll be hard not to see some of that. For instance, you know, the Italians got into the situation where they're having to take people off ventilators, older people off ventilators, to try and save younger people. We would hate to have to do that. And, of course, the doctors may have to do some of that if people don't behave responsibly and don't keep their social distance and don't do everything possible to stop spread. That doesn't mean, though, that we don't want herd immunity. The herd immunity we want is one that develops slowly because we've flattened the curve. And then what we would really like to add from the point of view of a herd immunity is a good vaccine. Because if we could take the people who've been infected and recovered, and then we could vaccinate everybody and have total herd immunity, it's a possibility this virus may actually die out.
Well, how far do you think we are from a vaccine?
The vaccine, we're all giving out the figure of 12 to 18 months. There are a few concerns from other experiments that were done earlier with SARS and MERS that some vaccine formulations, not all but some, could give you what we call a bit of immunopathology. That is, they might actually make it a bit worse or contribute to some bad situation. So we have to be careful with the vaccine. But the first vaccine product from the University of Queensland, I'm told, has already gone into lab animals. And it looks it's going well from what I know. And of course, in the United States, a different type of vaccine has already gone into people. So we have to go through safety testing. The first one is what we call a phase one trial, where we test it in people, make sure it's safe. And of course, we can always also bleed them and get antibodies so we can see what they're doing. That'll only be quite a small number of people. Then you go to a phase two safety efficacy trial with a larger number of people, and then you'd get it out there in a broader, much bigger trial where people might be getting natural challenge. But that's what takes the time. It's not really making the actual product at the beginning, but there'll be a time lag in actually producing a lot of the stuff. A lot of it is in the time you need to actually test it for safety.
We all understand it's a long process, but nevertheless, a year to 18 months does seem a very long time in this modern age.
Yes, it does. And a lot of us think that it may be possible to speed that up. It depends how well it goes. It really depends how safe it looks at the early stages. And of course, it's possible, as this is being done globally, and we and the United States and so forth are not the only countries doing it, that some people may push it ahead much, much quicker and take more risks to get to what could be quite a safe vaccine. If you think back, think back to the early polio vaccine, the measles vaccine, mumps vaccine, and so forth, they didn't go through anything like this extent of safety testing. There was a measles vaccine that was made early on, which was a killed virus rather than the live virus we use now, though that was damaging, and you wouldn't want to have pushed ahead with that one.
Now, we're seeing, obviously, progressively tougher measures being imposed, and various institutions and businesses shut down, causing a lot of social problems and dislocation. Would you like to see a more total shutdown to try to knock this thing on the head somewhat earlier than will be done through the staged approach?
Well, you can see how difficult that is. I mean, what's happening is the chief medical officer advising the prime minister and so forth, they have a staged response. Okay, so we've seen some staging of that, and it can go further. If these measures don't work, and they're pretty dramatic, really, what's been introduced. If that doesn't work, then we will expect to see more extreme measures. But you can see the difficulty of it. For instance, we've got all this social distancing, but then the Centrelink thing crashes, and you've got lines of people stretched out trying to get to Centrelink. So they're not keeping their social distance, and they would probably do so if they were in a different situation. So it's a very difficult situation. The other thing is, with schools, we're not really sure that schools are a major source of transmission. We do know that children can be infected. They don't seem to be as infected as much, and they certainly don't seem to be as severely clinically infected. But there are questions there. What about the children who are in socially vulnerable situations? What about the children of healthcare workers and essential staff? Because we can no longer call on granny, because granny's at great risk of severe disease. So it's a complex situation, and I think the way the response is working reflects that complexity, and it's why we haven't seen total lockdown.
Would you like total lockdown, though?
I think the natural instinct of a basic scientist is to go for it. But basically, as you think about the social issues and social context, you realise that that's a very difficult option. The government's being advised by top epidemiologists. These are the people who study the spread of infectious disease. And as far as I'm aware, now some of them are people from our institute, as far as I'm aware, they're acting on that advice.
What's your own position on schools?
Again, much what I said. I think it's a very, very difficult situation, and I'll leave that to the people who are actually who study the spread of infection. I study the nature of infection. I'm interested in what's called pathogenesis, how disease actually works inside the individual or the animal. But there are other people who are highly specialised and very skilled in trying to work out the spread characteristics and what determines them. We know with influenza from the work of Ben Cowling in Hong Kong, who's one of the guys who's been advising us, that influenza is certainly a major cause of infection in the home. We do not know that for this virus.
Your preoccupation is the science, but like everyone else, you have to organise your own life. Do you have grandchildren, and are you seeing them at all?
Yes, we have four grandchildren, and we won't see them for ages except at a distance. And if they come and stand outside, we can wave to them or have drinks at 20 paces or something, I don't know. So, no, we're not seeing our grandchildren. We're socially isolating at home. I'm doing everything by cell phone or computer and Skype or Zoom or whatever, and trying to obey the guidelines. We have a three times a week morning conference, an hour-long conference three times a week in the morning on what's going on in the Institute. It's all to do with testing, expanding testing, developing clinical trials, developing alternative vaccine candidates, developing antibody tests for screening, people we're collaborating with overseas, companies we're collaborating with, philanthropy, a lot of money coming in from various people, a whole complexity of issues. It's all extremely energetic, I should say. People are working 7 days a week. Some are getting exhausted, particularly on the testing side. And it's been an incredible experience to live through this so far. And, you know, if I live through it, I might try and repeat Daniel Defoe's book, Journey of the Plague Year, written by a scientist, and not in the 17th century, whenever it was.
Well, you'll certainly be able to update your pandemic book. Peter Doherty, thank you so much for talking with The Conversation today. And that's all from this podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back again with another interview before too long.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.